Thank you for joining me tonight. We'll be discussing the significance of the SpaceX launch that took place earlier this week in just a little bit with Dr. Jim Bell. Tomorrow, I'll be back with you again. A clinical therapist and parapsychologist, Brando Masalo, joins me to discuss the new cutting-edge research and theories that might explain things like apparitions, what causes a haunting, and the different types of communications that are reported from the dead, along with some of the latest research on the role that energy and electricity play in hauntings. And then in the later half of the show, a little bit of history and mystery, when author and paranormal expert Richard Estep talk about his intensive research into haunted Gettysburg and his tour of the battlefield where ghosts of long-dead Civil War soldiers are said to still march. That's what's going to be taking place on tomorrow night's show. I'm fascinated by the way our culture grasps the different historic aspects of our time. I remember growing up hearing my mom and dad talk about the moonshot and how people came together to watch these remarkable moments as we pressed past the confines of our own planet to try to make it to the moon, to try to put ourselves into the heavens. And this was something that was spoken about for weeks and weeks afterwards and was always on the tongues and the news stories. And now there's this strange disconnect. We are venturing in a private sector to a remarkable new realm, a new world, where we will be exploring outer space. But where's the interest? Why has NASA had to stop the space race? Why are there all of these breakdowns in something that we would continue to examine? We think we should continue to examine. I mean, it doesn't stop us from exploring the oceans. It doesn't stop us from exploring the highest mountaintops. And we've been there. Why did we stop going to space? Why did we stop traveling and looking into this? We'll find out from our guest and get some insights, unique perspectives on this and the future of space travel and exploration. We'll do that when we return. For George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. We're joined now by Dr. Jim Bell, a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona, an adjunct professor in the Department of Astronomy at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and a distinguished visiting scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Thank you for joining us this evening, Dr. Bell.
Hey, Dave. Great to be on the show again.
Why do you think there is such, I mean, this is an amazing, remarkable move in our world and in our science. Why do you think there's such a disconnect with people caring about space exploration?
Well, you know, honestly, I guess I take exception to that. I think a lot of people care quite a bit about space exploration. You see the enormous number of people who tune in when NASA lands a rover on Mars or when the Europeans landed on a comet not long ago. And people tune in to watch SpaceX launch their rockets. And people love to see astronauts and tune in to whatever Buzz Aldrin is doing these days. And I think there is a lot of interest. I think that, happily, it's one of the few sort of bipartisan or nonpartisan things the government really does and does well. It's something that the private sector is getting into quite a bit. Of course, it's something I think a lot of Americans are really proud of, the amazing things that NASA does. So I teach students and I interact with the general public a lot, write books and all that kind of stuff, and I see a lot of interest out there. You know, is it as in your face and crazy as the Apollo moon landings? Probably not, you know, but that was at a different time, right? That was us versus the commies, right? It was all about the Cold War, and, you know, national prestige was intimately tied up with the space program back then. But I still see a lot of interest out there.
And I'm not trying to say that in a disrespectful way, Dr. Bell, but it's, you know, I've got children. There's no excitement in the space race or space exploration. I ask them if they've covered this in school. What did they think of this? And What's SpaceX, Dad? What's going? They have no clue. It just doesn't seem to be as readily accepted, at least not in the schools in the Minnesota area. As I'm talking to my friends and their children that are in our areas, nobody, like I said, it just doesn't seem to have that grasp. And I know that there are a lot of adults like myself that are still fascinated by this.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly kids have a lot more options these days and things to get excited and interested about. But you know, one of the other hats I wear is as a president of a group called the Planetary Society, and it's an international space advocacy group. We've got more than 50,000 members, most in the U.S., but around the world. Website that gets hit by millions of people every month with all kinds of interesting blogs and updates on what's happening in the world of space. So I can tell you that there is a population out there, a significant fraction of people. I don't know if it's the majority of Americans or not, but a lot of people really do care about space, and a lot of people care about America continuing to lead the exploration of space.
Do you think that maybe there's a misunderstanding or misrepresentation that we kind of just threw our hands up and walked away from the space race? Do you think that might be why there isn't the same kind of excitement there once was?
Well, we won the space race, remember?
Right.
Right? There's American flags on the moon. And,
right.
So, you know, we won the space race, and things changed dramatically after Apollo because everything, you know, got focused on the space shuttle. And the space shuttle, as wonderful a program as it was not about exploration. It really didn't go very far from the Earth. You know, I tell students in my classroom, if the Earth is a basketball, if you take a dime and hold it on the edge of that basketball, the shuttle flew at the top of the dime, that close to the Earth. And that's where the space station is, and that's where roughly where the Hubble Space Telescope is. It's all relatively close to home. And so after Apollo, we spent, you know, the next 40 years or so sticking around close to home, and it's only with the robotic programs, the Mars rovers and the missions to Saturn with the Cassini and the Voyager missions to the outer solar system, only the robots have gone farther. But I'm optimistic about, you know, coming back to that, getting people back out into space. You know, NASA's rebuilding an enormous rocket that'll be comparable to what the Saturn V was back in the day, and of course SpaceX rocket that we just saw take off this past week, Falcon Heavy, capable of sending astronauts out to the moon and Mars and beyond.
What was the significance this past week with the launch from SpaceX, the Falcon Heavy rocket?
Well, I think you hit it in your opening segment there. I mean, you know, we talk about the historic points in the space program, you know, first people in space, and first to orbit the Earth, and first to land on the moon. And you remember, this is a private company led by a private citizen. That company, which is backed by the government in many ways, not fully, but in a significant fraction of their funding comes from government support. That private company just launched the most powerful rocket that has been launched in decades, and that's an amazing thing. You know, that it's going to be a big deal for the satellite business. You know, there's now there's, assuming it continues to work well in future flights, there's a new game in town for lifting big satellites or multiple satellites up into orbit for much less cost than the competition. And of course, there's lots of people talking about, you know, Elon Musk and his goals and his company's goals about eventually sending people out to Mars. And so demonstrating that a private company can do something of the scale that it's taken governments to do in the past in terms of rocketry is a really big deal.
And boy, what an amazing shot it was. And then to bring the landing in so beautifully and smoothly. I mean, it really gives you hope that, you know, this next wave is going to be really an amazing new jump for us, I think, in the way we handle space exploration.
You know, when I saw those two first stage rockets coming in for their landings
right
at the Cape, I thought I was watching like special effects from a movie. You know, it was like, wow, that's really incredible. It was just gorgeous. And you just get these chills down your spine. It's like, wow, we're really watching something historic go on here. And you know, of course, that's their model. Their model is reusing as much of the rocket as you possibly can, and that'll bring costs down. And other companies are doing that too. Blue Origin, Jeff Bezos' rocket company, very similar philosophy in terms of reusability. And we're starting to see some of the more traditional governmental rocket players adapt the same strategy.
Why was there a Tesla car and a mannequin driver in this rocket?
Partly, I think that was the chutzpah of Elon Musk. But traditionally, when you're testing a brand new rocket for the first time, nobody wants to put their very expensive satellite or other payload in there because it's very risky, and who knows if the thing is going to work. 27 engines firing at the same time in a yet untested design and flight, and so typically they'll put sort of ballast up in the nose cone, cement blocks or whatever, and just to make sure it has the right kind of weight, the right kind of mass up there, so to simulate if it would have a real satellite or something else up there. And, I'm sure they thought about doing that. And then Elon Musk being kind of a visionary and a little bit of mischief in his heart, said, no, let's try something else. And, of course, great cross-marketing move, right? SpaceX and Tesla, companies that he's both heavily involved with, of course. I think he and the company just had this sense that this would really get a lot of attention and would really excite people, and I've seen a lot of excitement, especially among students and school kids coming through our university on tours and talking about this kind of stuff. And it took guts to do that, and it was his own personal car, and I think it's better than throwing a bunch of bricks in the top.
Well, yeah, and it's good advertising.
Absolutely.
That's going to keep Tesla in the name in the forefront for quite a while here. But there was something unique about the mannequin as well, wasn't there, with the suit I was reading? Instead of using like a mock-up, they used one of the actual suits that they would suit up for these missions?
Yeah, well, SpaceX and Boeing are both working under government contracts to eventually help to resupply people to the space station, to NASA's space station. And of course, SpaceX wants to go on to Mars with their own missions, and so they're designing their own line of spacesuits and other equipment to go inside their capsules. And so, yeah, this is sort of the first actual space flight of some new astronaut equipment.
Hey, this is really exciting stuff. But I mean, if they came to you, Dr. Bell, and said, "Hey, Jim, you want to go on up in the next round? We're going to put you up there and send you up around the moon and back." Would you be willing to sign up, or is it still too much in its infancy for you to feel comfortable to be a client?
It's never going to be routine, right? Ever,
mm-hmm.
ever,
right.
ever. We're actually pretty jaded when you get into a commercial jet and it takes off and we eat a meal, watch a movie, do some email, whatever, and we think, gosh, this is routine. And you don't, I mean, the amazing amount of technology that's behind that and safety protocols and all that kind of stuff from decades of testing to get it to that point. But if you go back to the beginning of the airline industry in the 20s and 30s, with crazy startups with names like Northwest and United, it was risky. It was risky, and it was for the rich, and it was government supported. The government seeded that technology to help those companies come along. The government had done the same thing with the railroads back in the 1800s. So there's a long history of sort of government support to help these companies get their systems to be more safe, more reliable, less expensive, better technology, and we're seeing that same kind of thing happen with commercial and other government rocket programs today. Would I get into it? I don't want to go up and loop around the Earth. I don't want to go up and loop around the moon. If you could take me to the moon, if I could go to the moon for the weekend, I would totally do it.
But you're not interested in just even getting the shot around to get that perspective, huh?
I want to, I'm a geologist.
You want a bigger payoff,
Dave.
Right?
I'm a geologist. I want to get my boots dirty down there, you know, and get my rock hammer out, take some samples, you know, do some field work.
Look at that. You're talking about jaded. Chance to fly out and see something that very few people in the world, you're like, if I can't touch it, I'm not in.
Sorry.
No, I'm with you on that. I understand. I mean, this is pretty lofty, and you've got all of these independent groups that are now kind of in a new space race to get this handled and get up there. Do you think there should be some concerns with that, with cutting corners in order to try to be the first to do these things?
I think absolutely there should be concerns about that. And you know, these rocket launches are regulated. The FAA has it under its realm to certify launches. All of the players, all the major players in the game right now are all adhering to sort of NASA-level standards for safety and reliability. But, you know, do companies cut corners because they're trying to make money sometimes? Yeah, sometimes they do, right? So absolutely. Just like with the airlines, there has to be some oversight. And this is, you know, this is a new realm. You know, there were treaties back in the 60s governing space and transportation into space and mining and ownership rights and all that kind of stuff, saying that you know, all of this, everything out there is doesn't belong to anybody. It's all, you know, all of us together sort of have ownership of that. But now, you know, the world is changing, and we're talking about companies, you know, being able to get out there. You know, we at ASU, we work with some of the so-called asteroid mining companies. They're not mining yet, but they're prospecting, just like prospectors would do on the Earth before trying to mine a gold deposit or something. They're prospecting, trying to figure out where there's water and precious metals out there among the asteroids or on the moon. And so, you know, we're going to have to see a lot of work done, certainly at the national level, but probably at like the UN kind of level, to make sure that that all these systems adhere to the right safety standards, and that we work out all these ownership issues and rights issues for companies going into deep space.
I often wonder if I'm the only one that feels a little bit more comfortable knowing that all these groups are trying to do this, because if there is an asteroid hurtling towards Earth that you know, has some nefarious intentions for us, I like to know that there are multiple groups that have some skin in the game to try to figure out what they can do. And if you've got this many organizations doing that worldwide, I think that opens up a much richer vein of probability or possibility if we do come across one of these asteroids that gets a little too uncomfortably close.
Absolutely, Dave. You're absolutely right. And right now, it's really NASA and other space agencies that are doing that. Some of NASA's budget goes towards searching for potentially hazardous asteroids, ones that could be on collision course with the Earth. The European Space Agency, the Japanese, the Russians, telescope networks around the world. So there is a lot of effort. NASA works with the Department of Defense on this as well, because it is a defense, a national security issue, right? If something is on a bad path, it could be a really bad day and wreak havoc in our country or others. And so there is a lot of effort being spent to do a really complete survey. So we know right now where, you know, more than 90% of the pretty big asteroids are that come close to the Earth. It's the smaller ones, not the ones that could wipe out our civilization, but the ones that could, you know, do heavy damage to an individual city. That's where a lot of the action is right now, trying to complete the survey of those objects. But it's still going to take another, I would imagine, 10 years or more to really catalog all of those. There's a lot of stuff flying around out there. You hear these stories all the time, right? Oh, an object the size of a house just flew between the Earth and the Moon, you know, and the astronomers just picked it up one day ahead of time or something like that.
Let's pick up our conversation. We have to take a break. Dr. Jim Bell, our guest for the remainder of the show. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jim Bell, our guest for the remainder of this evening's show. With all of the different programs that are going on out there, Does there seem to be one that is just head and shoulders above the rest? Is it just Elon Musk and his SpaceX that's really the forefront leader in this group at this point?
Well, I mean, just talking about space exploration in general, I think the undisputed world leader is our very own national space agency, NASA.
Of course.
NASA's NASA, you know, outpaces and is outspends all the other space agencies of the world combined, and you know, and it shows. We've got amazing U.S. robotic vehicles all over the solar system exploring the planets, and telescopes and networks of telescopes on the ground, and Earth orbiting missions to study our own planet. So you know, and NASA also is supporting companies like SpaceX and other companies. There's a part of NASA that's called the Commercial Space Program, and that is a part of the government agency that helps to fund these companies, that contracts to them for services. So, you know, before they flew this big Falcon Heavy rocket, SpaceX has been flying the Falcon 9 rocket, which has been delivering supplies back and forth to the space station. The International Space Station, and other companies are doing that for NASA as well. So they are part of that that government spurring the business sector that I mentioned earlier. That also happened for the airline and the railroad industries in previous centuries.
What do you think is the end game, the real goals for SpaceX and Elon Musk?
Well, SpaceX is, people might think that they're in it to launch rockets and send cargo into space or ferry astronauts back and forth to the space station. That's not it. If you go look on their website or talk to people in the company, they have a very, very simple vision, a very simple mission, and that is to make humanity a multi-planet species. That's the goal of that company. And in order to do that, they have to learn how to build rockets, and they have to learn how to build them in a very economical way, which means learning how to reuse as much of them as possible. And they have to learn how to do reentry, supersonic reentry in the Earth's atmosphere. And since Mars is their first goal for colonization in the distant future, could, you know, many decades from now, maybe more, they have to learn how to launch stuff out into deep space, going to Mars, like the Falcon Heavy is just demonstrated. They can launch into deep space. They're going to have to learn how to land on Mars. They're going to have to learn how to live on Mars. All these things are part of the reason that specific company exists. There are other companies out there that are commercial space startups and run by entrepreneurs and visionaries, and you know, that many of them have the goal of, you know, launching people into space as tourists, or launching satellites into space as a business, communication satellites or other satellites. SpaceX is kind of unique because of the unique character of Elon Musk and the way that he thinks about the world and what he wants to leave as his legacy. And so a lot of people don't realize that that's the goal of that company, is to make humanity a multi-planet species.
What do you make now of the future of space exploration? Are we going to get back to astronauts going to the moon or heading off to Mars, or do you think they're going to scrap that in favor of less fragile beings, robotic astronauts, if you will?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm very optimistic. I actually think both are going to continue. I think that there's a lot of things that we can do with robots, like Mars rovers or the Voyager missions or the Cassini mission to Saturn or other, you know, there's dozens of robotic missions going on out there, and there's lots of things we can do with robots, and we should do those things with robots, you know, making the first reconnaissance of a place or determining the mass of an asteroid or things that you can program into a computer and harsh environments that you really don't want to send people, the surface of Venus or whatever. Let's do all those things with robots, and we have been successfully for 60 years now with NASA and other space agencies. Let's keep doing that. And there's also another set of things that I think we're going to have to do with people. You know, there's a whole bunch of science kind of work, field geology, deep drilling, things that you can't just program into a computer, especially when you're trying to figure out, you know, what happened here. You know, I'm a geologist. It's a forensic science. It's like, you know, CSI Mars or something, right? You know, you got to go there and you got to use your brain and your experience and your intuition and put the puzzle pieces together just like a forensic detective would do at a crime scene. And you know, we don't know how to make robots that can do that. And we may never equal the capacity of the human brain to solve those kinds of problems. So there's sort of a science and exploration reason to send people out there. And then, let's face it, I mean, lots of countries, including our own, use the space program as a projection of our power, as a way to foster national pride. You know, we spend a very small fraction of our immense national wealth to do these things. And sometimes it's not because we have to, it's because we can. And it, you know, it demonstrates to the rest of the world, you know, what an amazing nation we live in. And this has been, I mentioned this earlier, it's really been nonpartisan. Both parties, Congress is incredibly supportive, administration after administration, regardless of party, has been really supportive of this kind of way for America to lead the world. So I'm very optimistic. We've seen there were this big rocket I mentioned is being developed in the Bush, Obama, Trump administrations are all heading in the same direction with this rocket that could take, will be able to take astronauts back to the moon and on to Mars. It's much, much larger than the Falcon Heavy that we saw, much larger capability, much more expensive as well. And we'll see the first flight, first test flight of this rocket called the SLS, Space Launch System, coming up in a couple of years. So that'll be a really impressive and historic moment as well, sort of NASA getting back to the capability that we had with the Saturn V, which was sort of scrapped for the space shuttle. And so I'm very optimistic, Dave, that you know, within the next decade, NASA astronauts or maybe SpaceX astronauts might be on the moon, and maybe within another decade or two after that, we could be sending people out to Mars. Now, that all said, there's other countries involved with this too. The Chinese have a very ambitious space program. The Russians have a long and successful track record in space. Europeans have banded together to form a space agency that's been very successful. The Japanese, Koreans, other countries. So, you know, those astronauts that make it back to the moon next might not be NASA astronauts. They might be Chinese astronauts. They might be SpaceX employees. They might work for some other company that we don't even know the name of yet. As more and more people get into this game, more and more institutions and nations get into this game, I think you're going to see a lot of diversity there.
Aside from just the massive amount of time it would take to travel to one of these other planets to investigate with human life forms, what are the real dangers involved? I thought I remembered hearing that the big concern is blood issues in the arms and legs, our extremities, in traveling such a great distance between here and Mars.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about at a minimum 6 months to get to Mars, maybe more typically more like 7, 8, or 9 months to get to Mars, and a lot longer to go even farther out. So you probably heard of the twins study that NASA did with the Kelly twins, one astronaut up in space and one on the ground, and you know, it showed that space and other, you know, previous astronauts have gone too, have shown that space is a harsh environment, that humans were not made to be in space, right? We're made to be in this wonderful, warm, and moist cocoon called planet Earth. And when you go up into space and you lose gravity, you have exposure to radiation, like you said, a whole variety of medical issues can crop up. All of this has to get tackled, that's a lot of what the research is being done on the space station, is trying to understand in detail how to be able to get people into space for these long voyages. Maybe we're going to have to do something like, you know, the old movie 2001, where they spun the spaceship to create gravity. You know, that's one way to do it. You create an artificial gravity environment. Maybe there's other, you know, drugs or other exercise programs or other things that people are going to have to be doing to maintain their bone structure, their muscle mass.
Right.
You know, and then eventually let's, you know, put your thinking cap on and imagine the far future with people, let's say Elon Musk or others are successful and we're colonizing Mars and there's people living on this other planet. Well, it's a very different environment there too. It's only 3/8 of the gravity and lots of harsh radiation on that surface because there's no ozone layer. There's no magnetic field like the Earth has. So it's a harsh place. And if people are going to be permanently living there, you're going to be talking about very quickly, if they're going to survive, they're going to become a very different kind of people, adapted to that gravity, adapted to life in a much more harsh environment. I mean, you think that, you know, going west in the early history of America was tough. Going to Mars is going to be a real, real challenge.
Isn't it interesting, too, when you look at some of the factors of humanity, and that it doesn't seem like our physical structure was necessarily built for this planet either. And that, you know, animals do seem more adapted to this, but the human kind does not, or at least, you know, aspects of us don't seem to be. And that's where I think a lot of people come up with the idea that perhaps we're DNA, we're a mixture from other planets or galaxies or whatever that have floated through space to come here and have created this new kind of morphing version of what was once somewhere else. But you know, I'm just fascinated by, yeah, what kind of changes will we need to prep? And do you think it's interesting that they're doing all this work with DNA and genetic manipulation? I wonder if that is something that will be looked at for possible future space exploration.
Oh, absolutely, Dave, absolutely. Yeah. You know, for example, there is there's a kind of bacterium that is super resistant to radiation, and it's radiodurans is what it's called, and you know, it has DNA just like everything else on the Earth, and there's people who are trying to study what is it in its DNA and its structure that gives it that tolerance to radiation, and can somehow that be adapted to help us and people in space who are going to be exposed to radiation, or people on Earth who work in nuclear power plants or whatever, you know, and anyone who has a need for this kind of resistance. Well, you know, nature has solved that problem for this particular organism. And, you know, it's really kind of fascinating. You look all around the Earth and all the niches that life has filled on our planet, from organisms living in battery acid to super salty water to you know, deep under the ocean floor and deserts, and you know, nature has found a way to manipulate that DNA to allow organisms to survive in extreme environments. And now we're talking about putting ourselves in an extreme environment, and we're at a time when, like you said, we're learning how to engineer the genetics. It's both exciting and, you know, if you're a fan of science fiction films, potentially terrifying, right, at the same time.
Right. Yeah. Are we going to create these super soldiers for putting in space? And if so, how are they going to respond to that alienation and isolation as well?
Sure.
Well, I can't even, once we start doing that, sci-fi movies are going to take a whole new jump for us, Doc.
Exactly. Yes.
One thing I'm curious about, and I had 100 people contact me prior to the show today asking about the Van Allen belt, and how is it that we're able to go through that barrier and, you know, astronauts not be adversely affected from that?
Well, you know, the Apollo astronauts who went to the moon did it just fine. It's, you know, it's a protective shield more than a barrier. It's not a, you know, physical you know, it's not like plowing through a big snowbank or something, right? It's the magnetic fields of the Earth. It's high energy particles that are traveling along those magnetic field lines. When you're inside that shield, that magnetic field is blocking the most harmful radiation from the sun from hitting the Earth. And so it's actually, you know, part of the reason we're here is because of the Van Allen belts, because they shield the surface of the Earth from a lot of the harsh radiation that our star has. Now, when you travel out beyond them, now you're exposed. And if there were, you know, if there had been a really big solar flare pointed in the right direction when any of those Apollo missions between 68 and 72 were flying to the moon, those guys would have been in deep trouble. You know, they're deep trouble. And so we know that when we send people back out there, we can't just roll the dice like that every time. You know, we don't want to get people killed and fried by radiation. So the ships are going to have to be even more reinforced with radiation shielding, and water is a really good radiation shield, and heavy metals and things like that. So that is definitely an issue we have to deal with.
Dr. Jim Bell, our guest, as we continue, we'll start with your phone calls, emails, and more. You can email me, dave@darknessradio.com. I'll try to work in some of your questions throughout the next hour. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more to cover. You're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. For George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader.